Today's podcast is brought to you by Howie's new book, Paperboy. To order today, go to HowieCarshow.com and click on store.
Live from the Aviva Trattoria studio, it's the Grace Curley Show.
We got to bring in a new voice, a young voice, a rising voice, Grace Curley.
You can read Grace's work in the Boston Herald and the Spectator.
Especially Grace. Grace, stand up.
Here's the millennial with the mic, Grace Curley.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Grace Curley Show. Thank you all so much for joining us. Obviously, a huge news day, and it's only getting crazier as anti-Israel protesters are blocking the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Another mess that doesn't seem to be getting cleared up anytime soon. You know, I can tell you right now, if this was happening in another country, somewhere in Europe, people will be getting out and moving these protesters themselves. Do you notice that, Jared? That always tends to happen in other places. They're not as passive when it comes to people stopping traffic. I think what's going to end up happening is obviously there's going to be issues with ambulances trying to get through. But also, if you got people stuck on a bridge, I mean, I'm friendly with people. This is anecdotal, but it's my lived experience. I know people who get claustrophobic in an elevator or claustrophobic. I don't know if this is how you deem it, is like claustrophobia, but there's got to be people who are a little bit afraid of heights who are sitting up there in their cars having panic attacks right now thinking, you know what it's like? It's like when you go over a bridge, Jared, I don't really take a deep breath until I'm on the other side of it. Like I go over bridges. I'm not that afraid of them, but I don't feel...
Acrophobia is a fear of heights.
I don't enjoy going over them. I go over them to get over them. And so if I'm getting stuck there for these people, these pro-Hamas protesters, I'd be pretty peeved at this point.
Well, and like we mentioned too, I mean, you never know when Joe Biden's America when a bridge could just get hit by a boat, or in San Francisco an earthquake comes along, and that's problematic.
I've never loved bridges before, but I'm definitely more skeptical of them lately because of what we've seen over the last couple months and last couple years. Joining us now to talk about everything going on in Israel is Ben Weingarten. Ben, thank you so much. And for people who don't know, Ben is the editor-at-large at Real Clear Investigates. He's a senior contributor over at The Federalist. He's got columns at Newsweek. And also, he has a Substack, weingarten.substack.com. So, Ben, over the weekend, I know you've been following this very closely. Iran launched a massive ballistic missile strike on Israel. Before we get into the response from the Biden administration and what's next for Israel, I like your take on the reports and the U.S. To be full disclosure, they're refuting these reports. But Reuters had a story that Iran warned them ahead of time about these attacks and that the U.S. actually said that the attack had to be within certain limits. What do you make of that, Ben?
This is perfectly consistent with everything we've observed over the 11 plus years that we've had effectively the Obama-Biden-Iran first policy, which is that the U.S. acts as a partner and, frankly, a protector of the Iranian mollocracy, which is worth noting, has really been at the U.S. and shed U.S. blood, spilled U.S. blood, since its origins in 1979 in the revolution in Iran and the hostage crisis there. So the notion that there were back-channel conversations and that essentially the U.S. was playing all sides and quote-unquote managing the situation of, okay, Iran is going to attack within certain limits, and the U.S. is not only going to be coordinating and ensuring that Iran only goes up to just a certain point of an aerial assault, an unprecedented aerial assault on our purported closest ally in the region, and then the U.S. is also going to promote itself as the champion of Israel by saying, look at U.S. air defenses and how we helped protect Israel from this attack. And we got all these other nations on board, including Sunni Arab nations. And oh, by the way, what is the point of that narrative, which has not really been talked about in our press? It's about the U.S. administration saying, look, Israel, all of this normalization with your Arab neighbors can be yours if you'll just end the war in Gaza with a ceasefire. Let Hamas survive. Let us push forward with the establishment of what would be a Palestinian terror state surrounding you, and don't do anything to strike back hard and really take the war to an Iran that is sworn to your destruction and just engage in unprecedented assault on your sovereignty that no other nation in the world would tolerate.
Yeah, when you put it in those terms and you think about that quote that is being attributed to Joe Biden telling Bibi Netanyahu to take the win, it really does. It almost sounds like something a mobster would say. You know, you take the win, it'd be a shame if, you know, something had to happen. It's very, very strange stuff coming from a United States president. The other part of this I wanted to get your take on, and it kind of goes into what you're saying, Ben, is that there's reports that it was 99% of the missiles were intercepted by the Israeli army and their defense system. And the way this has been received, or the way this has been covered by John Kirby, and I'm thinking specifically of him, he said that Israel should enjoy the success of, you know, this defense system. And then you have Joe Biden saying, take the win. Call me crazy, but if another country launched ballistic missiles at us and we were able to defend ourselves, I don't think we'd all sit here as Americans and go, oh, yay, this is so great. We managed to stave off another attack a few months after people came in and slaughtered our people. Like, I just don't think we'd be as happy resting on our laurels.
It's insane. It's insane on its face. If you had another, if during the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union launched missiles at the U.S. and they just happened to miss and fall into the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean, would we say, oh, well, you know, too bad it didn't work out for them, but our defenses are great and let's take the win here, got lucky this time. I mean, think about, first of all, the margin for error here is something that's not appreciated in these discussions. Leave aside the fact that you have an Israel that's already been on a war footing and suffering and wounded from an attack that led to the equivalent of 40,000 deaths, and that the economy has been totally destabilized and derailed because you have huge portions of the country fighting, and that there are tens of thousands of Israelis who have been forced out of their homes in the north and made refugees in their own land because the Biden administration wouldn't let Israel take the war to Hezbollah right after October 7th. This is a New Jersey-sized state. There's no margin for error here. And, you know, say take the win. This win cost Israel likely billions of dollars. It paralyzed the country. There were some projectiles that did end up landing on targets. And Iran got not only massive actionable intelligence about Israel's defenses, but they also proved so far that they could invade Israel's airspace and sovereignty in an unprecedented way and not get a massive backlash that would destroy their regime, essentially, not just from Israel, obviously, but from the rest of the world. And Iran, of course, has the blood of the rest of the world, including the U.S. on its hands, again, dating back to 1979 and attacks on U.S. soldiers and personnel in Lebanon in the 80s and Saudi Arabia in the 90s and Iraq and Afghanistan with those roadside bombs Iranian made in the 2000s. So they got a ton of wins out of this, and the normalization of the idea that they can launch ballistic missiles or drones over Israeli territory is utterly terrifying. But leave that aside for a second. Let's note, Hezbollah itself really didn't activate during this. But next time around, you're not going to have warning and telegraphing and basically the U.S. coordinating to make sure that Iran doesn't strike too hard. You're going to have thousands and thousands of missiles launched from Lebanon into Israel. And again, in a New Jersey-sized state, the margin for error is zero here. Not to mention to the extent there are nuclear materials that Iran might have proliferated and handed off to enemies. And then you have reporting from the New York Times as recently as a week or two ago that Iran has flooded mass amounts of munitions into Judea and Samaria, arming Arabs that are right there on Israel's doorstep on one side. You still have Hamas in Gaza on the other side. You have in Lebanon Hezbollah, which is a far more formidable and sophisticated terrorist force than Hamas was. And then you have Iran and all of its other proxies. So this notion, take the win, how could it possibly be taken as a win when you have a country under existential threat and then the U.S. response is, got to deter Israel, can't let Israel escalate, quote unquote, when everything the Biden administration has done to restrain Israel and flow billions of dollars into Iran's coffers and appease it and not punish and deter its proxies leads to ever-increasing escalations. The only response is to massively, disproportionately escalate to cause the evil jihadists themselves to back down. But that's obviously not what the Biden administration wants, and that's obviously not what the quote-unquote global community wants. And I think the consequences are going to be devastating if Israel doesn't ignore the shackles that the rest of the world is trying to place in it and do what it needs to do to defend its sovereignty, just like we would do if we had sane leadership in America.
Yeah, you know what? When you keep saying take the win, which is obviously what Biden said to Bibi Netanyahu, you're right. It's incredibly insulting and dismissive of what happened to Israel over the weekend and this unprecedented attack from Iran. But something I want to ask you, Ben, you just mentioned how what world leaders want, what Joe Biden wants, what the international community wants. And what I'm really curious about, and we don't get a lot of reporting on this, is what do Israelis want? What are the people in Israel thinking? I know there's a lot of focus on Bibi Netanyahu and how he's right behind Elon Musk and Donald Trump. I would say at this point, he's the third worst person in the world, according to the mainstream media. But what do people in Israel want? And how did that change after October 7th? Because Israel's no stranger to having to defend themselves, but I would think that what happened on October 7th has really shifted things and realigned things in a way that we hadn't seen before.
Despite what our media in the West says, and despite what the Biden administration officials say, who suffer from Trump derangement syndrome, just like their elite counterparts in Israel, some at the top of military and intelligence, and then certainly in their media and political class, they have an analog of the Bibi derangement syndrome people there who have been trying to take him down for years as well. But it does not reflect what the public opinion polls in Israel reflect. And setting aside whatever the views are on Prime Minister Netanyahu, and you have conflicting polls about, do they want him as their leader? Do they want to call new elections? Because in their system, they can call elections. And it's much more fractious trying to keep a coalition together, even more so than, say, a Republican majority in the House. Here, the public itself knows that Iran is the head of the snake. They know a significant percentage is ready to go to war with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is probably the strongest of Iran's proxies. But after October 7th, of course, uniformly the population was for destroying Hamas in Gaza, not letting up in that war effort. Anything else would be intolerable, and that would cause a leader likely to get thrown out of office to not destroy and eliminate that threat. But the most significant and also massive opposition to the creation of a Palestinian effective terrorist state after you just saw what a Palestinian state looks like in Gaza, controlled by the elected Hamas leaders there, however many years back, you know, over a decade back when they were put in power and supported by the quote-unquote civilians on October 7th. But I think one of the biggest shifts in public opinion, and it relates to the opposition to the quote-unquote two-state solution there, is that you had leftist kibbutzim, you know, these farm communes, essentially. It was the left communities close to Gaza who believed in the idea that you can have peace with genocidal Palestinian Arabs, who ultimately woke up and said, this is intolerable because we saw what they did. We saw what happened when we tried to live in peace, when you had Palestinian Arabs coming in by the thousands to work in Israel and earn a living. What did they do with that? They served as the spies and infiltrators who ultimately helped serve as the tip of the spear for the worst jihadist attack in the history of Israel and the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust in a single day. So there's definitely a massive gap in perception between how the U.S. leadership operates as if it believes the Israelis themselves perceive the world and the threats versus where the Israeli people themselves are. And I will say, having talked to Israelis about this, that there is a shock and maybe a shift that hasn't fully happened yet, but they're coming, I think, to the understanding that America is not a reliable or dependable ally, certainly with a Democrat party in power, and that requires Israel to be far more independent, but it's very difficult because they don't have the industrial base to produce the weapons they need right now, today. And consequently, of course, this gives the Biden administration unique leverage over Israel. Unfortunately, from the perspective of the U.S. national interest, not just Israel's national interest, to Iran's great benefit.
Yeah, and Ben, I've got about 20 seconds here, but I have to ask you about all these pro, and this is how the media is describing it, pro-Palestinian protests taking place across the country, including the Golden Gate Bridge is being shut down right now. Yesterday, we had far less activists in Chicago cheering on Iran's attack on Israel. What's your response to that, and what's your response to how the media is handling it, if you could, pretty quickly here?
They're destabilizing America because they stand with genocidal jihadists, ultimately, who want to undermine the Judeo-Christian West writ large. And the U.S. is the little the U.S. is the great Satan, and Israel is the little Satan. And those who stand with our enemies are a disaster and shameful for this republic. And even worse is the fact that we have leaders that are actually holding American national interests hostage to these genocidal jihadist promoters.
Really well said. Thank you, Ben Weingarten. Everyone follow him at BH Weingarten on Twitter. Go to his Substack, weingarten.substack.com. And I'm always posting his stories. So get those wherever you can, including The Federalist, including Real Clear Investigates. He's excellent and he's the best at what he does. We'll be right back with more. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Grace Curley Show. This is The Grace Curley Show.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Grace Curley Show. Today's poll question is brought to you by JB Auto Care in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Keep your car, truck, or SUV running in tip-top shape. Get $20 off an oil change, conventional or synthetic. Call today and let them know Grace sent you, or book online at jbautomotive.com. Jared, what is the poll question and what are the results thus far?
Today's poll question, which you can vote in at gracecurlyshow.com, is how would you describe your concern over Middle East problems escalating? Not concerned, somewhat concerned, or very concerned?
If we had sanity at the helm, if we had, you know, people with who weren't telling Israel just to, you know, count your lucky stars that you avoided a massive slaughtering this time around, and maybe just sit on your hands and wait for the next one. Keep your fingers crossed for the next one, okay? But you did good this time. Isn't that enough? Can't you just be grateful? Take the win. If we didn't have those people running things here, I wouldn't be as concerned. But we have an administration that is very sympathetic towards Iran and has done gone out of their way to make sure Iran has plenty of money for these proxy groups, for these terrorist projects. I am very concerned about the Middle East. I think everyone should be.
59% of the audience agrees they are very concerned. 32% are somewhat concerned, and 9% are not concerned.
I gotta say, the more I see of these aerial drone footage of the Golden Gate Bridge, I don't think I'm someone who's very afraid of heights. I think I would be having a little bit of a freak out if I was stuck on this bridge right now. I just don't like it. I do not. You don't want to be stuck anywhere. I think being stuck in traffic like that and feeling as though you can't move anywhere is scary enough. I always give myself a lot of space when I'm coming up to a red light. I don't like anyone closely behind me. But this is on a different level. Pro-Palestinian protesters hit cities across the U.S. We'll talk about that.
People are home more than ever, and now is the time to clean or update your home with Kennedy Carpet's new luxury vinyl flooring that looks as good as wood. Kennedy Carpet is an old-fashioned company that still answers their phones and sends out their flooring technicians and not a subcontractor. Find out all of the new flooring options they offer today in your home or visit their beautiful showrooms in Needham and Weymouth. 1-888-KENNEDY. That's 1-888-KENNEDY.
Live from the Aviva Trattoria Studio.
I Everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. And Bragg was forced, after he declined for a long time to bring this charge, to do so. His predecessor rejected it. And so they took a dead misdemeanor and bootstrapped it into effectively trying a federal crime. But the federal crime here under election law was rejected by the Department of Justice. They didn't feel that this should be charged. So you have this crazy case that's going to go forward, and it's going to turn on the testimony of people like Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen just recently had a judge call him a serial perjurer. And he's going to appear as the center of this case.
Yeah, it's not a great way to start a case. And now we bring in our serial perjurer to explain to you how bad Donald Trump is. But it's not surprising to anybody that that's the road this is going, and that this is the weakest case against Donald Trump. And it's currently underway. It just started. I actually just read that Trump might have to miss Barron's high school graduation for this hush money trial, which seems crazy to me. But something else I wanted to point out, we keep talking about this, and that was Jonathan Turley on Fox. And we talked to Mark Salinas from Sylvan Salinas, who's done work for the Trump team as far as keeping Trump on the ballot here in Massachusetts. And one thing that keeps getting mentioned is we say this thing, we go, even liberal or even legal analysts who tend to have more liberal points of views all agree that this case is out of whack, that this is, you know, really trying to, it's like pretzel bending logic here to try to make this case happen. And I hate doing that. Like, one of my editors just recently said to me, stop doing this thing where you say the media and then you don't get more specific about it. You just throw it out there and then no one knows what you're actually talking about. So I'm really glad that I have an example for you. Eli Honig, who's the CNN legal analyst. It's hard for us to talk about Eli Honig ever because it just reminds us of the fact that the legal analyst at CNN used to be Jeffrey Toobin. And unfortunately, because of a situation with a Zoom call, which I'm not going to get into right now, he's no longer there.
Jeffrey Toobin?
But Honig wrote a piece for New York Magazine, which I think is actually the magazine that Jeffrey Toobin, maybe it was the New Yorker that Jeffrey Toobin was on the Zoom call for. But he wrote a piece and he presented, this is from Red State, he presented both the pro and anti-Trump ways of looking at the Alvin Bragg case. And here are just a few of the takeaways from Mike Miller about that piece. Donald Trump is about to face trial for conduct that happened 8 years ago. Again, this is CNN's legal analyst, okay? He's not, he doesn't have a MAGA hat on. The crime is, I'm skipping around here, it says, the crime is a paperwork offense relating to how Trump and his businesses logged a series of perfectly legal, if unseemly, hush money payments in their own internal records. Eli Honig is calling them perfectly legal. Not a great start for Alvin Bragg, I'll tell you that right now. The prosecution star witness is a convicted perjurer and fraudster who openly spews vitriol at the defendant, often in grotesque terms, essentially for a living. Oh, is that what Michael Cohen's up to lately? You become a professional anti-Trumper? I would say that is a new profession, Jared. I don't think people put it on their LinkedIns, but or on their business cards or anything like that, but it's definitely become an industry of people who just spend their whole... Rick Wilson, Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels. Who else would you call a professional anti-Trumper? Donnie Deutsch? What's his face? Keith Olbermann. These are, they're the best at what they do. They're the best in their fields. The prosecution star witness, it says the famously aggressive feds at the Southern District of New York passed on the case years ago, and current Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's predecessor could have indicted Trump before he left office, but he did not. The charges are either misdemeanors or the lowest level felonies, and the vast majority of defendants convicted of similar offenses are sentenced to probation and fines, not prison. So for all of the anti-Trumpers, get Trump contingency of the Democrat Party, that is not a good sign that CNN's chief legal analyst doesn't have high hopes. I wanted to switch gears here just for a minute. There was a piece today in The Federalist, and it got me thinking. It says, is Trump riding a realignment wave? And it talks about how throughout the course of American history, certain major events, cultural shifts, wars, things like that, have ushered in long periods of one party ruling or one party having control, not ruling, but having control for a longer period of time. And J.T. Young gives examples. So he actually says here, starting with Eisenhower's 1952 presidential victory, America's two parties have alternated presidential power with striking regularity. In 18 elections, only once has a party held the White House more than two terms. And he says the Civil War and the Depression clearly triggered realignments. What could be today's? So he talks about how up until the Civil War, it says, in short, an alignment that gave one party clear political dominance. Such was the case for Democrats in the 19th century up until the Civil War, for Republicans from the Civil War to the Depression, and then Democrats from 1932 to the mid-60s. Now, first, let me just say this. I'm not worried about a realignment for the next 20 years. I just think we definitely need a realignment for at least the next 4 years. I don't think we can survive much longer if we continue on this line. But this mindset of big events creating a realignment in the American political system did get me thinking, Jared. And I was like, why would there be a realignment right now? My first thought was COVID. I think COVID was a huge shift. But then I started thinking, maybe the border. Maybe the border causes a realignment. Like, if you had to say, okay, there's going to be a realignment for the next 10 years, there's going to be Republicans in the White House. What do you think would be the cause of that?
Oh, I would absolutely agree with you on the border, because
more so than COVID.
More so than COVID, because there were all, you know, we love to play the game, but there were a lot of Republican rulers who went along with COVID.
Yeah.
And you know, there was a lot of that. So I think the border definitely would be the realignment, because for the first time since probably the 60s, a favored group of Democrat voters is experiencing getting kicked to the curb for a different set of Democrat voters. Like in communities that had, you know, communities that were Democrat strongholds, they're now seeing the implications of, hey, we're bringing in a whole bunch of people who are going to be in your community and you're going to lose out on your facilities and we don't care what you think. So just shut up and take the burden of these people. And that really, for the first time, is going to awaken a lot of people to say, you know what? No, I don't want this. I want the people who want to stop these people who make my community unsafe from coming here, and I am going to vote for that.
Yeah, and I guess where I get nervous is this piece by J.T. Young talks about how if Trump were to win the White House this November, then that could usher in several more terms of Republicans. But where I get nervous is him getting through this November. I don't feel confident about how things are going to play out. I do get very nervous. I do think that they're going to throw absolutely everything at him. They threw absolutely everything at him in 2020. You know, you had Jane Fonda thanking God for COVID, saying it was a wonderful gift. Like, they were very open about that. There was no subtlety with what that whole game was that they tried to play by politicizing COVID, which I admit was very, for a lot of people, was very deadly, and it caused a lot of pain and a lot of harm. But I don't think there's any question that they were pouncing and seizing and weaponizing on this virus in order to take down Donald Trump. But my question is, if this realignment does occur, what do you credit it to? And Jared says the border. I would agree. I think there's definitely a big shift happening. I think you could make a case for COVID. And you probably could make a case, depending on how this is all going to play out with Israel, you could make a case for that as well. Maybe not for as many voters, but I think that there's some Jewish Democrats who are one-issue voters who do very much care about how we treat Israel. And they're not being fooled by Joe Biden playing both sides of this and saying, oh, you know, like, we support Israel, they're our ally. But then he's leaking to the Washington Post or to these, like, to these publications, I'm really mad at Bibi. That's not fooling anybody. Everybody knows exactly what he's doing. I wanted to, Jared, really quickly here. This is a new segment of ours, and I really enjoy it. This is where we let Jared be the judge. It's Judge Jared. We give Jared a situation. We ask him, what would you do? You know, if you've got the gavel in your hand and you're wearing the fancy robe, There should be.
Powdered wig.
There should be a hat, really, when you think about it.
I feel like I'm a powdered wig guy. I would like that for my judgeship.
Okay. Okay. A white wig. A nice white.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll see what I can do.
Ascot.
I'm still working on the gavel, honestly, and since I haven't made headway with that, I doubt the wig is going to be part of my list here, but I can envision it. Now, Jared, here is the circumstance. You've got these protesters. I'm just going to go with, I know it's happening all over the country right now. The highways in New York and other places are being shut down from these anti-Israel protesters. But I, Jared, just want to get your take on the Golden Gate Bridge, that the protesters who have, at this point, I'm sure it's hours and hours and hours of traffic lined up behind them. These people are now going to be, you know, waiting a very long time, not be able to get to where they're going. I'm sure there's people who have to get through. There's probably health emergencies that are not being taken care of. What is the sentence for the protesters who are blocking the Golden Gate Bridge, sir?
So I actually, you know, and judges can do this. They can take ideas from other people. I saw this on Twitter today, and I actually think this is the way to go outside of, you know, vigilante justice like they have over in Europe, where you just kind of pick them up and you toss them to the side of the road, which you probably can't do on a bridge. I mean, you can't just toss them off a bridge.
Things are tight.
You know, but somebody said that people who block highways, and, you know, this harkens back to, you know, maybe in reverence of OJ last week, false imprisonment or kidnapping charges. If you block a highway and you stop somebody from getting to their destination for a certain amount of time, I think they should be charged with false imprisonment and whatever statute penalty comes with that.
Okay. Judge Jared rules again. Thank you very much, sir, for your time. The Honorable Judge Jared. I wanted to read you one more story. Oh, but one other thing, Jared, to your point. It's like, yeah, you have every right to protest. You don't have every right to shut down a working bridge.
No, disruption of commerce is not a protest.
You don't have every right to stop an ambulance coming through for someone who had a heart attack and now can't get to the hospital. You don't have every right to stop me from going to work to make money to support my family.
You can't cry wolf in a crowded ambulance.
You can't cry wolf in a crowded ambulance. How many times do we have to tell you? Yeah, nobody listens nowadays.
It's in the Constitution in the back somewhere.
Take a hammer to it. Take a hammer to that Constitution, man. Taxpayers paid more than $4.5 million on Secret Service protection for Hunter Biden in 2021. This Secret Service protection will be a bargain, I tell you. So a new report shows, this is from the Post-Millennial, that Secret Service spent more than $4.5 million between 2021 and 2022 protecting Joe Biden's son, Hunter, when he was living in his $6 million Malibu home in California. I just wanted to mention here that that does not include the cost to pay the agents. This is just to house the agents nearby. And the agency was paying $30,000 a month to rent Hunter's neighbor's house. And this is what a retired Secret Service agent told ABC. He said that's the cost of doing business for the Secret Service. Typically, whenever wherever a protectee sets up their residence, the Secret Service is forced to find some place to rent nearby at market value. The service has had to do this in the past administrations, and unfortunately, the housing market right now has driven the prices up substantially. Why is that? Why is everything so expensive nowadays? I just thought that was interesting. $4.5 million to protect Hunter Biden. Must be nice, right? To protect Hunter Biden, who, by the way, is constantly being persecuted and prosecuted by vengeful members of his father's DOJ. But I'm glad to know that that hasn't stopped him from shacking up in Malibu in his beautiful... You know, isn't that a situation where you just go, hey, let's just make it easy on everyone, get a normal apartment somewhere? But no, not for Hunter. He needs to be outside. He needs to be in Malibu. He needs to be in a beautiful spot because he needs a muse. Malibu is his muse for all of his artwork. And sure, it's going to cost money, but you got to spend money to make money. The Nosepeach Inn, speaking of beautiful places, the Nosepeach Inn just opened reservations for spring, and you don't have to have Hunter Biden's budget to stay at the Nosepeach Inn. You can stay there for just $259 a night in May or $249.99 a night in April. Such great deals, incredible views, so much to do. Cape Cod is a beautiful spot, and it's so spectacular in the off-season. I don't think people give the off-season enough credit. We are heading, though, into summertime, Jared. It's going to start, you know, it's going to start getting busy in the Cape. And that's what I love about Nasa Beach Inn, though, Jared, is the rest of the Cape can be crazy busy. But Nasa Beach Inn, it's like a little slice of peace.
So, yeah, you definitely want to get that peace. And it's the best place to get it because every room has a picture window so you can take in the ambiance and stay nice and cozy in your room. If it gets a little chilly at night for you at the beach, you can turn on the fireplace because every room has one of those as well. Whatever room you're in, you are steps from the beach, so you can take it in. You can almost have a private beach to yourself and the other people who are staying there. There's fire pits. You can gather around the fire pits. You can have a good time. The Cape Cod Rail Trail is around there. There's plenty to do. They're pet friendly. You can bring your dog down. You know, if Howie wanted to bring Roscoe, he could just traipse along in the sand. Or if Toby wanted to bring Arlo, whoever you want to bring down there, you can bring down. And you can just have a great time at the Nasa Beach Inn.
I wonder if Roscoe's a get-in-the-sand kind of dog. I could see Roscoe, just from what I've heard, he might say, you know what, Howie, let's stay up here by the fire pit. Keep our toes clean. There's no reason for us to go that far. I also don't know how Roscoe feels about water. These are all things I'm going to have to ask Howie. Right now, you can book your April stay at Nasa Beach Inn. Go to NasaBeachInn.com. That's NasaBeachInn.com. Don't go anywhere. We've got Toby Leary coming up next. We'll be right back.
Follow Grace on Twitter at @G_Curly. This is the Grace Curley Show.
We've got some breaking news here, so just hold on with us one second. Today's car crossover is brought to you by ReadyWise. With inflation, food, and energy costs rising, families are feeling the financial pinch as they struggle to make ends meet. Preparation is key, and our friends at ReadyWise have emergency food kits that will provide peace of mind. Go to ReadyWise.com and use code Howie20 at checkout to save 20% on your order. Joining me now is Toby Leary. Toby, thank you so much for coming on. I want to first get your reaction to this. The armorer on the set of the movie Rust, where that horrible shooting occurred, that was a movie produced by Alec Baldwin. He was holding the gun at the time. He claims he didn't pull the trigger. The armorer was just given the maximum 18-month sentence in the fatal shooting of Helena Hutchins, who was also on the set. She was, I believe she was like the cinematographer or something like that. But a really sad, awful story. What's your response to this sentence, 18 months?
I think it's appropriate for, you know, the person who's in charge that causes a fatality. You know, I think it's a tragic story all the way around. Don't get me wrong. You know, I don't think there was intent there by anybody on the set. However, when it's your job to ensure the safety of that set, as it was for that armorer, she failed. And the worst part was there was a well-documented list of failures leading up to that. So it was 100% preventable had they done the hard thing of making changes earlier on when there was failures along the way. So ultimately, I do believe that the buck stops with Alec Baldwin for not doing that. So there was failures along the way that didn't get dealt with that ultimately led to him pulling the trigger because it didn't just go off. He pulled the trigger and killed the producer, which was awful. And it was a terrible story. So I think he still needs his day in court for being the guy in charge and not doing what needed to be done and the hiring and the safety protocol there. But at the end of the day, it was her job to keep that part of it safe and she failed. And so, yeah.
Well, he is going to get his day in court. I think he's slated to appear in July. Toby Leary is appearing on Howie's show next. He'll be filling in for the captain. He's got an excellent program prepared for you. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So don't go anywhere. And congrats to all the marathon runners. Keep it up.